I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, the Graveyard of Empires. That's what many call Afghanistan. I mean, just look at what happened to the British Empire and the Soviet Union when they tried to mess with Afghanistan. And now we can add the United States to that list. But is there reason to question the Graveyard of Empires trope and the way it is deployed, especially in light of the United States' withdrawal from Afghanistan? Our guest on this edition of the program, Alexander Khalili, says there is, and he is the author of a recent piece at the Ajam Media Collective entitled Why We Need to Stop Calling Afghanistan the Graveyard of Empires. As Alexander notes, if we are to go back to ancient times, Afghanistan wasn't exactly the graveyard of empires, but arguably the cradle of empires. Additionally, Khalili argues that the Graveyard of Empires trope has been employed by the West to wash its hands of responsibility in regards to Afghanistan's woes over the years. Does that mean we should reinvade Afghanistan, or that the withdrawal was the wrong move to make? Khalili doesn't think so, but he does believe that we need to have a more nuanced and complex understanding of Afghanistan and other countries in that region. So, without further ado, let's get to the conversation with Alexander Khalili on whether or not Afghanistan is really just the graveyard of empires. Also, I almost forgot, this conversation was recorded on September 2nd, 2021. With that in mind, let's get right to the conversation. Welcome to Parallax Views, Alexander Khalili, author of the article, Why We Need to Stop Calling Afghanistan the Graveyard of Empires. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for having me on the podcast.
So I guess where we should start, I'm assuming all my listeners are familiar with this term, Graveyard of Empires, because I've had probably 5 to 10 guests on in the past week alone that have used that term. But for people that don't know what that means, what are we talking about when we say the graveyard of empires? What is that narrative?
Well, I'll give you the short version first, and then maybe we can delve more into the history of that. In short, when we call Afghanistan the graveyard of empires, the idea is that Afghanistan is uniquely and timelessly either unconquerable and or ungovernable. So the idea is that this is a land that for all of its history has been inherently or naturally resistant to invasion, and no one has really succeeded in conquering it. And of course, that narrative seems stronger when you look at recent history. We've got the United States withdrawal now, which is what it's being used to explain the Soviet war in the 80s, the Soviet invasion, and then of course the British experience in Afghanistan in 18. I mean, the one, there were actually several Anglo-Afghan wars, but the one everyone knows about is 1842, when the whole British army of, you know, some 17,000 troops just got wiped out, except for one man who made it back to Jalalabad. And so there's this idea that, you know, don't invade Afghanistan because you will lose. That country will eat up your empire and spit it out. So that's, you know, that's the idea in a nutshell.
So I have to ask, I feel like this was a very specialized sort of term or narrative until recently. And I think there is a reason that it has come into vogue. Apparently, Joe Biden has started using this phrase.
Yeah. So, I mean, the origins of this phrase. So it may sound, you know, this kind of sounds like a piece of timeless wisdom, like something that maybe Alexander the Great had said. You know, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. But actually, it only came into being, as far as I can tell, in 2001, after the US and her allies had already invaded Afghanistan. So there was an article in Foreign Affairs by Milton Bearden, who used to be the CIA station chief in Pakistan, and who was actually involved in the arming of the Mujahideen during the Soviet invasion. And he wrote this article for Foreign Affairs, which was sort of like this cautionary article entitled Afghanistan, the Graveyard of Empires. And there he basically lays out this historical case that Afghanistan, defeated, for want of a better word, Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, the British, the Russians, and he was warning that now it could do the same to us, to the Americans. And so it seems quite a prescient article in that sense. And so he's sort of warning about getting bogged down in Afghanistan and sort of making some suggestions there. But then what happened is this phrase or this trope gradually found its way out into books, articles, media interviews. You know, people started repeating it. So you have in 2010, two books, not one, but two books in 2010. So about a decade ago, released with The Graveyard of Empires in their title. So this, it kind of, you know, this, it, it's a catchy phrase and it appears to be true. And it also appears, and if you think about it, in 2010, that's when things really started to get difficult in Afghanistan. Like it started to become clear that, you know, this phrase basically started to appear, you know, really gain prominence in 2010. So you have two books where the phrase The Graveyard of Empires appears in the title. And, you know, more than that, it sort of goes out in op-eds and media interviews and so on. And it's quite significant that it really starts to gain traction in 2010, because I would say, you know, 2010 is around the time when everyone is starting to realize that we may not have won this war, that, you know, we may not have actually defeated the Taliban. And this could be, you know, this could not have a happy ending. Yeah. And of course, now that the withdrawal is happening, this is the phrase that's being deployed. You know, before Joe Biden, there were already op-eds and cartoons going back to, I mean, the cartoons are my favorite, because this trope gets so overused in cartoons. Just yesterday, the Washington Post opinion section had yet another Graveyard of Empires cartoon. So I'm thinking of starting a collection of these. But these started appearing, you know, over the last few months as the withdrawal, you know, as the withdrawal date came closer. But I think, you know, we reached peak Graveyard of Empires when Joe Biden gets up to address, you know, America and the world, defending his decision, you know, and his handling of the withdrawal, of the Afghan withdrawal. And he actually says, you know, Afghanistan has historically been known as the Graveyard of Empires, and it's never been a united country, and it's impossible to build a nation there.
Is it surreal hearing him say that?
I think I almost spat my tea out. I couldn't believe that the president of the United States was, for want of a better word, uttering such gibberish. I mean, whoever wrote that for him, whoever, you know, put that in there as some kind of justification, I was honestly, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's a nice turn of phrase, but it's completely untrue. I mean, it's just completely historically inaccurate, and it explains nothing. It's just it's literally just that. It's a cool sounding phrase. And to hear the president of the United States, it was almost as if when I heard that, I said, wow, if Joe Biden is saying the reason why things went badly in Afghanistan is because it's the graveyard of empires, he's desperate to give some kind of explanation to this. Like, things must be really bad. And of course, we know now that they were, you know, this is, and we've known for some time, but it's just now, I think a lot of people in the American public and in the British public, you know, over here, you know, Afghanistan was sort of something we had tuned out over the years. And then just to see everything that, you know, that the Americans, the British and their allies had worked for in Afghanistan to just go up in smoke in the space of 3 weeks. I mean, even when the Soviet Union pulled out, the government limped on for another 3 years before finally being defeated. But in the case of, in the case of the US-backed government in Kabul, within 3 weeks, it was gone. Everyone had either, you know, fled the country or headed to the hills. It was definitely, I think the fact that Joe Biden used the phrase is indicative of just how bad the situation looked, the fact that he needed to invoke that.
Now, I know I'm going to have listeners that are very used to the term. I've actually used it myself at times. I will cop to that. why is it historically inaccurate, though?
Because, you know, Afghanistan is and has been a land of many empires. I mean, you know, you could be forgiven if you just look at the British and the Russians and go, yeah, Afghanistan's a tough place. But the narrative doesn't stop with the British. The narrative goes all the way back to the days of Alexander. In fact, there was an article recently published in a military history magazine that listed the Persians, the Greeks, the Mongols, the Arabs as people that tried and failed to conquer Afghanistan. The thing is, all of those people conquered Afghanistan. Alexander the Great conquered Afghanistan, and he left behind a legacy of about 300 years of Greek kingdoms ruling in Afghanistan. And even after the Greek kingdoms left, Greek culture, Greek script, Greek deities, those things all remained and became part of the fabric of the society there. The Arabs invaded Afghanistan. No one's saying it was easy. I mean, this is a mountainous country. It is difficult to invade. But guess what? So is parts of Iran. So is other countries. There's nothing, you know, especially there is nothing uniquely difficult about invading Afghanistan that you can't find elsewhere, I would argue. And I think the testament to that is just how many empires both conquered Afghanistan and how many empires established themselves there. So you have a long history as well. This isn't just a case. So again, you know, someone made the point that, oh, actually, lots of empires conquered Afghanistan. So it's more like the roadkill of empires, which is also complete, you know, nonsense. Afghanistan was conquered by the Greeks. It was conquered by the Mongols, the Arabs, you name it. It also gave rise to several really important empires through its history, especially in the medieval period. It may be hard to imagine this now, given the current state of the country, but for hundreds of years, Afghanistan was basically the center of the world. You had cities like Balkh, like Herat. These were imperial capitals. Balkh, for example, if you want to get a sense of the culture and importance of these cities, Balkh is the city that gave us the most famous poet of the Islamic world in the English language, Jalal ad-Din Rumi. His family were from Balkh originally. If you look at Herat, you know, the city of Herat, if you went to Herat in the 15th century, it was teeming with scholars and scientists and poets and grand architectural projects. In fact, as I mentioned in the article, there's a phrase attributed to the founder of the Mughal Empire in India, because again, not many people realize this, but he got started in Afghanistan. His first capital was in Kabul, where he's buried. But he visited Herat, and he described Herat by saying, "It's a city where you can't stretch your leg without kicking a poet." So that gives you a sense of the rich culture that was there. And so, you know, when we say Graveyard of Empires, it sort of conjures up this perpetually backward, desolate, you know, place where empires go to die. And yet for hundreds of years through its history, Afghanistan was more like the cradle of empires, or you could call it even the crossroads of Asia because of the Silk Roads the Silk Roads that went through there. It was an important center of trade. And, you know, from Afghanistan, if you were building an empire, you could go north into Central Asia, you could go east into northern India, or you could go west into Iran. So it was actually a very important strategic location. And so it's just complete nonsense to say that no empire since the days of Alexander has ever ruled Afghanistan. There were tens of them. There were tens of them, and they were some of the most fabulous empires that the world has seen. So that's for the ancient times. But then, you know, people will say, well, okay, fine, I get it. It was great, you know, a long time ago. But what about the British? Well, this is where it gets interesting, because the British were famously defeated in 1842. You know, the whole army was wiped out. And it's true. There was one guy, the army doctor, who made it back to Jalalabad. I mean, it was like he was the last man standing. He was all that remained of the army. And this, of course, was, you know, famously captured in a painting called Remnants of an Army by Butler, which is, you know, which sort of gives you an, you know, which captures this idea quite nicely. You know, this one ragged individual making it back to the fortifications, the safety of Jalalabad, where the British were. But that's not the whole story, because in the same year that happened, another British army came and they took cities, and it was a punitive expedition. They got prisoners back who'd been taken from the army that was destroyed, and they won. So, you know, 1842, yes, there was this huge military disaster, but in the same year, a punitive expedition came in order to punish the Afghans for this, and it was successful. Then flash forward a few decades to 1880, and that's the conclusion of the Second Anglo-Afghan War. So again, the British invade Afghanistan, and not only do they defeat the Afghans, they manage to put their own candidate on the Afghan throne, and they turn Afghanistan into a client state. So they turn Afghanistan into a nation that is basically a protectorate of the British Empire and has no independence from the British Empire. And this state of affairs continues for 40 years until Afghanistan's independence in 1919. So, you know, when you look at the British, again, it wasn't simply the case that the British, you know, the British invaded Afghanistan and then, you know, left with their tail between their legs. They were dealt a severe defeat, but they adapted, they came back, and they won. And even with the Russians, you know, with the most, I mean, we've all seen the clips from Rambo 3 that are circulating on the internet at the moment. Sort of, you know, in I think especially in the American mind, it's the experience of the Soviet Union, the image of those tanks leaving across the Friendship Bridge to what is today Uzbekistan, that sort of captures the futility of invading Afghanistan. The idea that the mighty USSR, the, you know, that Ronald Reagan called the evil empire, basically was, you know, defeated by these ragtag Afghan Mujahideen. Again, quoting Reagan.
And,
you know,
and Rambo 3 even has the dedication. It says, this film is dedicated to the brave Mujahideen fighters of Afghanistan, right?
I mean, that's just, I mean, that aged well. You know, as far as I know, they actually changed that in subsequent releases to the enduring spirit of the people of Afghanistan. But at the time, it was dedicated to, you know, Islamist militants, which I find, you know, astounding, just how things change. So with the Russians, you have, you know, this the mighty superpower of the USSR humbled in Afghanistan. But again, what people forget is it isn't quite that simple. I mean, yes, there were difficulties the Russians faced because of the terrain, because of the people.
But it wasn't just Afghanistan involved in all of that. It was also Saudi Arabia, the US.
Pakistan. I mean, there was a whole other team there that, although there were no troops, I mean, there were no American troops on Afghan soil. There was a lot of American dollars there. You know, they were basically funding and equipping an insurgency. In fact, we even have, you know, the phrase, the stinger effect from the, you know, from that insurgency, because of the idea that by supplying the Mujahideen with Stinger missiles, America fundamentally changed the balance of power in the Afghan Soviet conflict, because they enabled the Mujahideen to start shooting down Soviet aircraft. So they actually challenged Soviet air superiority. But again, you see it. So this isn't really the case that Afghanistan defeated the Soviets. This is the case that America and its allies, especially Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, funded and supplied a massive insurgency, and they bled the Soviets dry. I mean, the Soviets wanted to get out for years before they finally did, because they could see that this was an unwinnable war. But it was unwinnable precisely because the other side was willing to sink so many resources in it. So yes, there were.
In other words, not to interrupt you, but in other words, we can't separate the Soviet-Afghan conflict from the Cold War machinations at play in it.
No, any more than we can separate the Vietnam conflict from it. I mean, you know, you can't look at, you know, or the Korean War. I mean, it's impossible to look at the Korean War without looking at Chinese involvement with, you know, with North Korea. It's impossible to look at the Vietnamese War without looking at, you know, the Soviet support for North Vietnam. Equally, when we look at Afghanistan, we can't look at it in isolation from, you know, these broader Cold War proxy wars that were going on across the world, where the Soviet Union and the United States were basically funding insurgencies against government, you know, against governments they didn't like. In the case of Afghanistan, you have the Soviets being defeated in Afghanistan, but they were being defeated by American-backed forces there.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we continue our conversation on this edition of Parallax Views, I want to notify California listeners of the program about one of our sponsors, the therapy practice of Alexander Yu. Yu is an experienced teletherapist since 2008, and he goes by the motto, Flow, Adapt, Change, as Lao Tzu would say. And he wants to accompany you on your journey of self-improvement. Now, again, this applies to California listeners of the program. Alexander is a licensed psychotherapist and teletherapist. And if you'd like his services, then please contact him at Alexander U. That's Alexander U, YOO.com. And he can be reached by email at therapy@alexanderu.com or by phone at 323-834-9828. That's 323-834-9828. This is only available, once again, to my California listeners. But if you need anything related to therapy needs, please be sure to contact our sponsor, Alexander Yu. So, you know, with all that history in mind, so we've gone through that history, but, you know, I can still see people saying, well, what's the big deal with using the term the graveyard of empires? I mean, it did become sort of a quagmire, so to speak, that we got involved in there. But there is sort of an orientalism to it, and maybe, you know, a racist undercurrent.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I think for a start, so I think the first thing I'd say is, you know, when you call it a graveyard of empires, that's incredibly disrespectful to all the Afghans who've lost their lives over the decades in these imperial wars that have been fought there. You know, the people who've suffered the most, you know, if Afghanistan is a graveyard of anything, it's a graveyard of the Afghan people, because so many of them have been killed in these wars.
Can I add to that real quick?
Yeah.
I feel like the Afghan people were often caught up in the middle of, you know, what Zbigniew Brzezinski called the grand chessboard. You know, there's a lot of you know, Afghans are sort of sacrificed in a way. They're sort of caught in the middle of a big storm.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one way of looking at it. I mean, I would be careful not to say that the Afghan people and their leaders have no agency whatsoever. I mean,
I was clearly, just going to say maybe I'm foolhardy in saying that because I could see how that's taking away their autonomy. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's a balance that has to be struck, right? So it's I think there's several things here. So the problem with the graveyard of empires is, first of all, it's this idea that Afghanistan is innately this way, that it is innately unruly, it is innately ungovernable.
It's innately barbaric is what people are saying barbaric. When they use that, yeah.
And then the Afghan people are innately warriors, resistance fighters. You know what I mean? It's sort of, you're basically essentializing a country of, you know, tens of millions of people and saying they're just this one thing. It's completely two-dimensional. So I think number one is sort of the Orientalism there, that we're basically projecting an image onto Afghanistan. For a start, the data is wrong. So the image lacks historical basis. That alone should be enough to discard it. But even if you wanted to sort of play devil's advocate and say, yeah, but you know, what's wrong? It's a poetic turn of phrase. Well, you know, it may sound good, but it completely dehumanizes the people of Afghanistan. And it also, perversely, it's blaming the people of Afghanistan for their current situation. I mean, if the Taliban coming back is because Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, then isn't that the same as saying that it's Afghanistan's fault and the Afghan people's fault that the Taliban are back?
It's and sort of a Pontius Pilate thing, you know, oh, we can wash our hands by saying this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what it does. I mean, when Biden said it, you know, I found it incredibly cynical, because what he's basically saying is, you know, I mean, what did you expect was going to happen? We couldn't do anything about this. This was, you know, this was beyond our control. I mean, you know, I think I call it in the article the ultimate humble brag, because it's like saying, oh, woe is me. I could do no better than Alexander the Great. You know, it's both self-aggrandizing. It's like, oh, we are this great and mighty empire. We're sort of, you know, it puts us in the company of all of these illustrious empires throughout history that have tried and failed to conquer Afghanistan, which again is completely untrue. But more than that, it also says that our failure in Afghanistan isn't our fault. If there was any mistake we made in Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires is saying that our mistake was to try in the first place. I mean, I actually saw a tweet where someone said, you know, when an opinion columnist said that, you know, we Americans are holy fools for democracy. In other words, you know, the reason why we failed in Afghanistan is because we're just so naive. We were just trying to do good, you know, but we have to be more realistic about these things. And then what this has the effect of doing is it completely dismisses all of the actual reasons why the US and US allies failed in Afghanistan, you know, why the nation building project failed. You know, there's no mention of the drone strikes. I mean, you know, there's been some excellent work done by Gopal, who wrote, is it No Good Men Among the Living? You know, where he's actually gone out to the rural regions of Afghanistan. So he's got out of the cities, he's gone to the Pashtun regions, he's gone to Helmand, he's gone to Kandahar, he's gone to the heartland of the Taliban to see how people there are experiencing the American occupation. You know, when you're killing hundreds of people at a wedding with a drone strike because you think it's like a terrorist compound, you know, what do we expect is going to happen? You know, when... I mean, even Stanley McChrystal, when he came to Afghanistan, he publicly acknowledged that we need to fix what we're doing with these airstrikes because they're turning people against us. So I think the graveyard of empires narrative covers that up. So it covers up the fact that you know, massive civilian casualties, especially outside the cities. It covers up the corruption. So, I mean, a lot of work's been done. I mean, if you look at the Afghanistan papers, it's all there. If you look at a recent article by, you know, Ali A. Onomi in the Washington Post, he explains this quite well. Just the government, the whole government was irredeemably corrupt, and we propped that up knowing that it was corrupt.
I keep thinking back to, I think Ghani actually wrote a book called Fixing Failed States, which in hindsight That is pretty hilarious, given he sort of just fled and took a lot of money with him. I think that says everything.
I mean, that is one of the great ironies. I mean, there's two guys here. There's two guys here with books who I think are worthy of mention. One is Ghani with his fixing failed states, which he didn't do. What he would probably say is that the reason I couldn't do it is because Afghanistan wasn't a failed state. It wasn't a state at all, because none of the apparatus of the state were actually there. But I think the other honorable mention for guys who wrote books, on topics that they know, that maybe they were shown not to know so much about, is Donald Trump's Art of the Deal. Because let's not forget that the current situation is in part the result of the deal negotiated by the Trump administration with the Taliban directly, which basically effectively gave up all of America's leverage when leaving the country. And handed it. They did everything but hand the keys to the Taliban. It was an atrocious deal, and it was done without any representative of the Afghan government there. It was done without any representatives of the Afghan people there. It was a deal between the United States and the Taliban, and the end result was that it was a lousy deal that Trump negotiated. It's almost comedic. You can just imagine the Taliban there reading the Art of the Deal to know.
I'm just imagining
how Trump is going to negotiate with them.
Not to interrupt you, but I'm just imagining Trump being like, well, they're good fighters. I like that. I like that about them.
How did that happen in the first place? That you're making a deal with the Taliban without even having a representative of the Afghan government that you've been supporting for the last 20 years there. It's just unthinkable. So, I mean, there are multiple failures. There are military failures. There are, financial failures. There are all of these different areas where there are concrete, tangible failures that we can point at, and we can say, this is why we failed in Afghanistan. And you know what? None of them fall under the graveyard of empires. None of them are actually to do with Afghanistan. A lot of them are to do with us. When I say us, I mean the West, what we did in Afghanistan, especially the Americans and the British. Our military efforts were ineffective. And then, nation building as well. Just we made a lot of crucial missteps along the way. And the graveyard of empires completely covers that up and basically says that the Afghan people and the land of Afghanistan are responsible for their own misery, which is just perverse. Go on.
For me, what's interesting is I have liked the term in the past. Your article got me rethinking it a little bit. But when I would use the term the graveyard of empires, for me, I think it was sort of a graveyard for the imperial hubris of the U.S. But it wasn't because of the Afghans, in my view. It's always been because, I honestly feel like we went into Afghanistan not knowing anything about the culture or the people. And to me, that's not on the Afghans. That's on us. I mean, we have articles coming out in Business Insider recently talking about how experts have been saying that, the troops weren't trained to know anything about the Afghan culture and the different ethnic groups, the Tajiks, the Hazaras, the Pashtuns. That's all on us, though. That's not on Afghanistan. I think it's a sign of our own hubris.
I mean, that's absolutely true. And I think the other thing that's telling is that after 20 years in Afghanistan, the state of public knowledge about Afghanistan is incredibly poor. It's funny. I saw an Onion article from 2001. So The Onion, a great and reliable news source, which actually made fun of people who became overnight experts on Afghanistan. And what was funny about the article is it got so many details about Afghan history right in 2001 that major newspapers and publications still can't get right today. So, for example, the fact that it was conquered by all of these empires, I think the Onion article is one of the few articles that I've seen that actually that gets the history reasonably accurate. The state of public information, state of public knowledge. And I think there's been a real disconnect in terms of drawing on expertise, because there are people who understand the history and culture of Afghanistan. They don't seem to be consulted. They don't seem to be drawn upon. Now, I'm sure that there are, you know, there are people who, you know, I'm sure the CIA and the State Department and, you know, various other global intelligence agencies and foreign ministries have people who are Afghanistan experts. But I think the issue is really that our leadership went into Afghanistan without any clear aims of what it wanted to achieve. The problem was, you know, obviously in late 2001, in October, you know, we wanted to get Osama bin Laden. And at first the Taliban said no, but then they said, well, what if we handed him over to a third party to stand trial? So we won't give him to you, but we're happy to hand him over to a third country and he can stand trial there. And so then that sort of put us in a bit of a bind, right? Because they're kind of agreeing to our demands. But then the rhetoric changed so that by November and December of 2001, we were talking about making sure that Afghanistan can't be a safe haven for terrorists. So now we're talking, we've got the language of nation building, you know, and human rights and women's rights, and all of these things. And so we went in. Now, here's what gets me though. You know, by the end of 2001, we'd effectively won the war. The Taliban had been utterly defeated.
And then we end up in Iraq.
There's two things. Yes, we end up in Iraq. But before we end up in Iraq, the Taliban say, we want peace in exchange for amnesty. We will stop fighting you and you will give us an amnesty. And then we can, you know, just go back to being school drivers, school teachers, bus drivers, and farmers, or whatever. We can just get on with our lives. To quote Gopal's piece, an interview with Gopal that I saw on, I think it was MSNBC today. You know, the Taliban were ready to sort of just say, okay, we lost. Just, you know, let us walk away from this, and we'll stop fighting. There were members of the Taliban who wanted to be part of the government in Kabul. They were willing to sort of enter the political process, take part in elections, those sort of things. And, you know, the Americans just said no. You know, Rumsfeld said no. You know, the idea is we don't negotiate surrenders. They wanted unconditional surrender from the Taliban. But when you think about it, what the Taliban was asking was very small. All they were asking for is a chance to walk away from the fight. And if you think about it, you know, had we taken that deal in 2001 and the Taliban had, you know, made peace with the new government, the new order of things, if they had entered the political process, is there a chance that things would have ended up differently? It's possible, right? You know, certainly it was a better deal than the one that we took, you know, 20 years later when the Taliban had all the cards, when the Taliban had the leverage, because they knew that we didn't want to stay there forever. In 2001, we had all the leverage. All they were asking for was amnesty. So, you know, that was a missed opportunity. And then, of course, as you said, already in early 2002, what's happening? We're ramping up the rhetoric on Iraq. Powell is in front of the UN with his mobile biological weapons labs. You know, the famous images that he held up. You know, talking about how Iraq has WMDs, and all of which, by the way, he later admitted, like this mobile weapon program, you know, was not solid. It was not based on good intel, although he'd been told it was at the time. So already in 2002, we can see the rhetoric ramping up on Iraq. And then in 2003, in March 2003, we invade Iraq. It's no accident that it was in 2003, I think, the Taliban said, we are now resuming we're resuming our fight against the Americans.
I just wanted to add too, I even think, and this is just based on various people I've talked to, that I would consider experts on Afghanistan. And I don't want to be one of those people that acts like an expert. I always tell people, you know, everyone thinks they're Patrick Coburn or someone else has been writing about Afghanistan now, and they're really not. I don't want to be one of those people. But my understanding is that I'm not even sure that we understand what the Taliban is real well in the public imagination. I mean, you know, I think there's differences between rank and file and leadership And I my understanding has also been that a lot of younger people in Afghanistan would join the Taliban just because the Taliban would give them money and, you know, they wanted to feed their family. Some of it wasn't even ideological. I mean, there's also ideological elements of the Taliban. I'm not denying that. But yeah. I think there's different elements at work within it in the mix.
There is. I mean, the Taliban is a complex movement. I mean, there are at least three factions within the Taliban. And those three factions do not necessarily see eye to eye on everything. There are differences between them, you know, in how they want to, in how they envision the future of the country. And there's also differences, by the way, between the leadership in Doha, who are, you know, who until recently were giving all these nice press conferences, but who weren't actually on the ground. And then the foot soldiers on the ground, there's a big gap there. And even now between the sort of the spokesman in Kabul, who's giving these very sort of, you know, rather polished press conferences, you know, they've got people who speak English, they've got, you know, they've got social media accounts, they're sort of doing all this messaging. There's a difference between, even within the different factions of the Taliban, I would argue that there are going to be differences between the leadership in Kabul who are sending out, who are trying to sound reassuring. I mean, they tried to sound reassuring, but I think if you listen to what they're saying, there's still a lot of kind of like, wait, what? There's a lot that they give away that indicate they are not going to, you know, that there is not going to be an inclusive democracy in Afghanistan for the foreseeable future. But they're trying to make it sound like they're good. They're trying to sound, you know, they're trying to strike a conciliatory tone. They're trying to seem like that, you know, that they haven't just been waging a 20-year campaign of guerrilla warfare and terrorist bombings. So there's a divide between them. And I think it's interesting, right? Because when the Taliban sort of took Kabul, they were saying, you know, there's going to be a general amnesty. And yet we already knew at the same time they were saying there would be a general amnesty, people were being dragged out of their homes and executed. So, is that because the leadership is saying one thing and doing another? Or is that because actually the leadership is saying one thing and it has no control over the ground? That's the other question.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that real briefly. One thing that I think gets lost in the shuffle is, you know, the leadership may want one thing. We can't really know. I don't know what the leadership actually thinks compared to what they say. But, you know, I mean, the rank and file have been fighting this war. As you mentioned, weddings were bombed and whatnot. So a lot of the rank and file are just out for blood. They're like, well, we want revenge now. And, you know, there's so many different elements at play in all of this.
Yeah, and I think the other element as well is, of course, the ethnic element, which is, you know, the Taliban is still primarily a Pashtun movement. And so if you look at all of the people that are being put into positions of power in the new government, they are primarily, you know, Pashtun members of the Taliban. And something that, you know, and that's also a source of concern to Afghanistan's other, you know, ethnic groups like Tajiks and Uzbeks, because, you know, they feel that a Pashtun government, a Pashtun-dominated government, won't reflect their interests. And so there's that aspect too, which the Taliban are going to have to contend with. But
were the Pashtuns well represented under Karzai and Ghani?
I mean, Karzai himself was Pashtun. He was from a Pashtun tribe, and I think that's one of the reasons why he seems to have been, you know, with hindsight, quite effective in brokering deals and holding the country together. He understood, you know, he was able to play the role of head and state quite well. Whereas, by all accounts, Ghani, again, I have no firsthand experience of this, but Ghani was rather abrasive and managed to alienate a lot of the people. He would need to fight for him, and so I mean, if the leadership has managed to, you know, if the leadership lacks the necessary skills to maintain the loyalty of the people that are going to fight for it, then that is another explanation we have to look at. So again, you know, but then if you look at that, sorry, just going back to the graveyard of empires. So again, we can look at Ghani and we can say, look, this is something that the Afghan leadership did that was a mistake. So Ghani, I think, you know, with hindsight, was a terrible head of state for Afghanistan. He was, you know, he did a terrible job. Because it was under his watch that the Taliban regained the control of the country. But I think there's a reason for that. You know, we can point to his failings as a statesman and the failings of his government. And so that's not to blame the Afghan people for that. But, you know, that's not like, at the same time, we're not saying, oh, it was all the evil Americans. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, the US and US allies definitely made mistakes in Afghanistan, and they, and you know, there were some, you know, especially when you look at the civilian casualties, this was terrible. But there were also Afghan leaders who made decisions that led to the Taliban's rise. I mean, for a start, there were a lot of Afghan leaders who were using the war on terror to settle scores. You know, so they were basically pointing U.S. counterterrorism towards people and towards groups that were their rivals, but weren't actually necessarily involved with Al Qaeda. So, you know, I think the point is there is a lot going on there that gets lost to the general public. You know, so when we say the Taliban, we sort of have this impression of this unified movement. Actually, I think the Taliban are probably just as surprised as everyone else that they're in Kabul at the moment. You know, I think they are still adjusting to the fact they now have a country to run, and they've got some serious challenges facing them. And it will be interesting to see whether they have any more success than the previous government in ruling Afghanistan, especially given the fact that they have got pressure now from the Islamic State in Khorasan. You know, IS's Afghanistan branch, who are actually recruiting disaffected members of the Taliban. So recruiting members of the Taliban that feel that the Taliban have sold out or somehow diluted their ideology. And so are now willing to join ISIS in, well, it's called, there's sort of lots of names being thrown around it. ISIS, ISIS-K, you know, ISK, or, you know, if I'm not mistaken, there's another group called the Khorasan group that's actually different from ISK. So, okay. But I don't know enough about that to comment. But the point is that ISIS, you know, the group we know as ISIS, you know, in Syria and Iraq, has a franchise, as it were, in Afghanistan, and that franchise, unlike Al Qaeda, is not allied with the Taliban. So you've had Al Qaeda issue statements congratulating the Taliban, wishing the Taliban success. Whereas IS, on the other hand, the Islamic State group, they basically, you know, they see the Taliban as sellouts because because the Taliban were willing to negotiate and accept a specific territory. Whereas in the minds of the Islamic State, you know, the jihad should not stop. That it should be a global struggle, and it should never end. And it's interesting because if you look at some of the reports coming out of Afghanistan. So there was a report recently from Bagram Air Base, in which I think it was it the Washington Post or the New York Times? Their reporter there was interviewing members of the Taliban on the ground, and they were saying this shows the great power of jihad and faith, and you know, we're going to make Afghanistan a base for global jihad. And I just wonder, to what extent does the leadership of the Taliban share that aim, or to what extent is this empty rhetoric, you know, this sort of, you know, for political consumption, and to what extent are there people that actually believe that, and that if the Taliban don't follow through, and let's face it, if the Taliban are smart, they're not going to follow through on that. You know, are those people that feel the Taliban has lost its way, that the Taliban isn't committed enough for their liking to the ideology of jihad? Will they then just, you know, will they join the Islamic State, and will the Taliban be facing an insurgency in Afghanistan?
My understanding too is that a lot of this, and again, I've already proven myself the ignorant Yankee because I brought up Karzai, and as you noted, he's a Pashtun, and I didn't even recognize that. So we're proving the point here about ignorant Yankees, but with myself being the example. But I also think there's differences between the Taliban and this ISK group that people aren't taking into consideration. A lot of people think they're like the same thing, which is very, very weird to me. I mean, it shows a lot of public misunderstanding. And I think people have difficulty absorbing things like the difference between Salafi and Diabandi Islam and just all of these things. Even I can get, you know, I was telling you before we went on air when we talked last week, you can get really bogged down in it. It can feel, you know, overwhelmingly complex.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think this is, if you look at,
you cut out right when you started speaking when I.
Okay. Let me try that again. So, I mean, I think this is the nature of all sorts of political movements. I mean, even if you look at the Republican Party in the United States, it's not one party. It's cobbled together from various interest groups, ranging from, you know, free market libertarians to people that read The Handmaid's Tale and saw that as a blueprint for a, you know, a future society. You know, there's a broad church element to the, and the Democrats are the same. I mean, you know, in the UK, you know, the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, all of these parties are vehicles for several different groups that have come together because they share some degree of common interest. And I think the case with the Taliban and ISK is they're both, you know, they both share some things in common, but they also have a lot of important differences too. So
I think that's also true of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, right?
That's true. I think the difference is that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were able to work together in spite of those differences. So even back in the 90s, there was friction between Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda on the one hand and the Taliban on the other. And that's partly ideological and that's partly also theological. So, you know, the Taliban, I don't know that the Taliban have ever been a movement that's been committed to this idea of a global jihad. You know, or a global Islamic state. They've always been very interested in having sort of an Islamic emirate. And I think that's a key term as well, because, you know, ISIS want to establish a khilafah or a caliphate. They want to have a caliph, which means they want to bring back an institution that is in theological terms meant to represent the continuation of the Prophet Muhammad's authority on the earth. So the caliphate has sort of this important theological significance, whereas an emirate doesn't quite have the same theological significance. So an emirate is someone that's headed by an emir, which simply means a leader or a ruler. So, you know, so the ideological ambitions, I mean, I think in the case of Al-Qaeda were definitely more global in their outlook, but they were willing to work with the Taliban, you know, in a mutually beneficial relationship. The difference is with IS that IS take a much harder line than, if you can imagine it, IS take a much harder line than Al-Qaeda. And their view is that, you know, it has to be a global struggle. It has to be a global fight. And we have to reestablish a caliphate. So from the perspective of IS, the Taliban are sellouts. They've compromised these pristine ideals. And this, to some extent, also goes back to their respective theologies, because as you alluded to, ISIS, the Islamic State, are Salafis. They come from, that, you know, an ideology that, you know, is largely based in Saudi Arabia and which has kind of spread across the world, you know, thanks to Saudi oil money. That shouldn't be taken to mean that all or even most Salafis agree with the ideology of the Islamic State. The Islamic State are sort of a radical offshoot of Salafism. But they are Salafis, whereas if you look at the Taliban, they are Deobandis. Deobandism is a school of Islam that comes from the Indian subcontinent and is drawn from a school of thought called Hanafism, which is very popular in Central Asia and India. And so without wanting to get bogged down too much in the theology, there are important differences in their thinking and in their intellectual genealogy, if you will, that lead to practical differences on the ground too. And so, you know, you can see with the Taliban, they seem to be much more flexible in terms of trying to strike a conciliatory note with people who don't agree with them. For example, with Shia Muslims in Afghanistan, the Taliban have been trying to put on a friendly face. That doesn't mean that they're ready to accept Shia Muslims as equals by any stretch or give them real religious freedom. But I think at the moment, the Taliban have made the calculation that they need to antagonize as few people as possible until they've consolidated their role. But
I was going to say, just real quick, do you think that maybe... Biden recently said when he was asked about the Taliban, he thinks that they're facing an existential crisis. Do you think there may be some truth to that?
To be honest, I don't know the answer to that question. And I don't think I don't know that Biden does either. you know, we have to be careful of wishful thinking. just because we would like the Taliban to be having an existential crisis now they have power doesn't mean they will. You know, it's possible. They're, as I said, they're facing massive challenges now because before they were an insurgency. Now they're a government. So now they actually have to run the country. They have to collect taxes. They have to pick up garbage. I mean, you know, they have to give press conferences. I mean, they were taking questions at Kabul. I think it was at Kabul airport about dogs that were left behind. People were asking about the welfare of the dogs. And you could see the face of the Taliban spokesman. I think he was dying a little bit inside that he was, you know, it's very glamorous being a guerrilla fighter. It's sort of almost romantic taking on the United States with just your Kalashnikov. And now you have to give a press conference about some dogs that have been left behind at an airport by the evacuating forces. It's, you know, there is going to be a reality check there for them. And let's face it, last time they were in power, the Taliban weren't a particularly brilliant government in Afghanistan either. You know, the fact that state institutions were so emaciated in the first place, and that effectively, you know, the nation building exercise was almost starting from the ground up, is because of the Taliban, because the Taliban had invested so little in actually building the proper infrastructure of a nation state. And even now you can see sort of, there was a video going around which purported to show a Taliban military parade, and it was the saddest military parade I've ever seen. You know, sort of just not impressive. I mean, you know, if you look at countries like China, North Korea, Iran, they know how to show off military hardware. It looked like the Taliban were trying to do the same thing, but weren't really sure how to do it. So they're still figuring this out, how to be a government.
I think that's the frustration that a lot of people in the West have, and just Western media and journalists, is we're trying to read tea leaves when I'm not sure that we can at this point in time.
No, I mean, I think there's a lot that's still in flux. I certainly can't. I mean, you know, by training, I'm a medievalist. So, you know, ask me anything that happened more than 200 years ago, and I can give you a reasonably good explanation of that. But one thing I have learned from studying the past is that people are really bad at predicting what's going to happen. You know, you get, you know, throughout history, you get all these predictions of, you know, of the future, of who's going, you know, who the next king is going to be, of who's going to win the war. And there's all sorts of factors that go in there into the actual outcome that you can't even see. So this is what, I guess this is what, you know, Rumsfeld meant when he spoke about there are known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. There are a lot of unknown unknowns in Afghanistan at the moment. And
I was going to say, Rumsfeld wasn't completely wrong with that line. I know he gets made fun of a lot for it, but
no, actually, I think that's probably one of the things he said that's aged rather well. And by the way, I think it was a mistake to sort of portray the Bush administration as somehow incompetent. They were incredibly competent. They enacted their vision for the Middle East with lightning efficiency. There was no incompetence there, and I wouldn't, you know, even Bush himself, I think a lot of people underestimated him and what he was doing. And I think the fact that he's been rehabilitated to a great extent in the American media, at least, and he can actually deliver, if you've heard any of his recent speeches, he gives very coherent, very well-worded speeches. And you're just thinking, where was this George Bush for 8 years?
Yeah, I was going to say, I always wondered if his sort of, aw, shucks, folksy vibe was just, you know, a little bit put on, you know, a little bit for the public.
I mean, that's a possibility. And as I said, I mean, you look at the Bush administration, they were very effective in enacting their vision for the Middle East. And we all have to live with the consequences of that now. So to some extent, though, you know, we are trying to read the tea leaves now, just as we were in 2001. In fact, in 2001, you know, at the end of the Afghan war, things were looking, people were sounding cautiously optimistic. You know, you had editorials talking about how we need to build up Afghanistan, how this can't be allowed to happen again. And yet here we are 20 years later and the Taliban are back. I don't think in 2001 anyone could have seen that outcome. And I think, you know, we can envisage various kinds of scenarios. But what I hope doesn't happen is another bloody civil war, because if there's one thing that Afghanistan as a nation doesn't need, and the people of Afghanistan don't need, is another, you know, is another two decades of conflict. You know, I think that's if there is any silver lining to this so far, it's been the relative lack of bloodshed. Although, of course, the Taliban have been carrying out, you know, retribution attacks, and, you know, we aren't going to get, you know, the Taliban are not going to set up a liberal democratic government or the kind of government that you and I would probably want to live under. But I would say that if there is an end to the bloodshed and the conflict and the destruction, that at least is something positive. Although I wouldn't credit, you know, I wouldn't credit the Taliban with that. That's not their doing. I do think that we have to be careful about making any sort of predictions that, you know, the other one is that China is now going to invade Afghanistan. It's like, we may like, you know, some foreign policy circles may like the idea of China getting bogged down in an unwinnable quagmire, but that doesn't mean China's going to do that.
So before we close out, I just had maybe one or two more questions. The first being, you know, I'm going to have a lot of listeners a lot of my listeners were very supportive of the withdrawal. And I want to make clear, I don't think the argument you're making about, you know, putting to rest or retiring the graveyard of empire's narrative has anything necessarily to do with whether you support the withdrawal or whether you were against the war or whether you were for it or whether you were against the withdrawal.
That's absolutely right. Yes. I mean, I want to make clear that just because I'm saying it's not the graveyard of empires doesn't mean I'm pro-imperialism, which seems to be the takeaway that one or two people on Twitter had to the article. I can only assume they didn't read the whole article.
What was the worst reaction you had to it?
I think someone actually called me an imperialist shill, which was kind of wild, considering I'd just written a whole article on how the graveyard of empires is basically a kind of grammar of imperialism. Like, this is actually this trope is used as a justification for imperialism. I'm surprised
they didn't throw the old, are you working for MI6 or the CIA?
I mean, I think I blocked them before it got to that stage. But, you know, I think the issue is that when we look at the graveyard of empires as a trope, this is about justifying imperial failures. It's about justifying the withdrawal. And sometimes the way in which you withdraw is equally imperialistic as invading the country in the first place. So remember, you know, just as when the British left India, for example, you know, we can talk about that being the end of British colonialism in India, but in a way it wasn't, because then you had partition and all of the trauma and violence associated with that. So, you know, withdrawal is just colonialism by other means. It, you know, it throws up a whole load of other problems that are brought about by virtue of the occupation having been there in the first place. And so I think it's important to say that, you know, the graveyard of empires is very much sort of a critique of this grammar of benevolent imperialism that Biden and co are trying to sort of prop this up with. And I think we can definitely talk about why withdrawal was necessary. We can even talk about why the war was a bad idea in 2001. We can say why this was a bad idea in the first place, but we can do it without reducing Afghanistan to a two-dimensional stereotype. And that's key, because if we want to learn lessons from this, if we want to actually, you know, actually have a sober evaluation of what went wrong, of the mistakes and indeed the crimes that were committed in the course of the occupation, then we have to do away with these oversimplified narratives, such as the graveyard of empires. And I think, you know, we can debate the merits of withdrawal. Personally, you know, I don't see how we could have the West, that is, I don't see how America and her allies could have remained in Afghanistan indefinitely. You know, so withdrawal was necessary. I think, however, you can also see why the withdrawal made sense, but at the same time criticize the way in which it was carried out. I think the chaotic scenes at Kabul airport, the fact that the American forces left Bagram Air Base before, you know, Kabul, I think the fact that they left Bagram Air Base in the middle of the night without telling anyone, which is, you know, the military equivalent, I suppose, of saying you're going to the store to buy a pack of cigarettes and then never coming home, it was definitely a cut and run. And I think we can say that is wrong without saying that withdrawal is wrong. So you can be in favor of withdrawal, but you can be against this withdrawal. You can say this withdrawal could have been done better. And this goes back to what I said earlier about the negotiations. You know, a good negotiation, a good outcome to negotiations with the Taliban would have been a process by which the government would remain and the Taliban would accept the government, and there would be a peaceful transition of power to whatever the next stage, you know, whatever comes after the American withdrawal. So there would have been some sort of agreement in place. America could have used its leverage rather than just running, basically, just getting out of Dodge, as it were, and leaving behind so many people. I mean, I think, again, the other thing we have to consider is there are a lot of people who risked their lives for, you know, the Americans, for the British, for other Western powers, and they've been left behind at the mercy of the Taliban. And this is before we even get on to things like human rights activists, women's activists, journalists, artists. I mean, there was a musician who was in Andhra province who was taken out of his home and killed by the Taliban. So before we even get to all the people who believed in the vision of Afghanistan we were selling them, there are the people who actually risked their lives for us, who actually, you know, in some cases picked up a rifle and fought for, you know, fought alongside American and British forces. And those people are now stuck in Afghanistan with the people they were fighting against, and they've just been totally abandoned on the tarmac. So again, I would say the graveyard of empires, what I'm pushing back against is sort of these oversimplifications of history and of the present, which don't actually explain anything, which prevent us from learning any lessons, and which paper over in a very grotesque way the huge amount of misery we caused, not just through the occupation, but that we're continuing to cause through the withdrawal. And I think also you kind of touched on this before, but another reason why I'm pushing back against this idea of the graveyard of empires is that it isn't just the graveyard of empires. We come across these tropes everywhere when we're talking about regions of the world outside of the Western bubble. So we have people, I've lost count of the number of times conflicts have been explained by ancient hatreds, the Sunni Shia conflict, for example, rather than looking at the real geopolitical reasons for conflict, for example, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, this is explained as ancient hatreds. Rather than looking at the real causes of sectarian conflict in Iraq, ancient hatreds. Even when
Israel Palestine.
Yeah, I mean, I was building up to that. Israel and Palestine, ancient hatreds. I'm just kind of like, you know. So let me get this straight. So everywhere, you know, when we talk about European history or North American history, you know, there is a system of cause and effect in place. When we talk about anything happening in the Middle East, these people have just hated each other forever, and they always will do. I mean, this is and this is the kind of stuff that you find in op-ed columns. I mean, Thomas Friedman over the years has been especially, I mean, he's the guy that wrote, what was it? Was it in November 2001? Give War a Chance. And in another op-ed, he talked about how Afghan civilians, and he says civilians in scare marks, in scare quotes, which is kind of worrying. He says Afghan civilians were praying for another round of B-52 bombers.
Right. I, my understanding is Thomas Friedman, he just thinks that, if we just put a McDonald's in every country, you know, it's the Golden Arches theory. You know, yeah. If we put a McDonald's everywhere, then the wars will end.
or the Lexus and the olive tree. I mean, he literally wrote the book on this idea of, if we can just get them to stop fighting over these damned olive trees and get them building Lexuses instead, then, all of the world's problems would be solved. So it's not
real quick. I just want to relate this story. I actually was I had a teacher who wanted me to read that in one of his classes in college. And I threw the book down and I said, I can't do this.
I haven't actually read the book. I read the article that I think was the basis for the idea of the book, and that was enough for me.
No, same here.
Yeah, it was just I'm not reading that book, and you know, which is a shame, because someone like Thomas Friedman has this really prominent platform, and he's had it for, you know, 30 years. He's had 3 decades, and he's used that to really just push out these massive oversimplifications, which have actually caused us it's not just the fact we haven't learned anything from them. They've actually done something more harmful. It's not just Thomas Friedman, by the way. There are plenty of people that do this, but Thomas Friedman is the one who comes to mind because he's the most famous example. You know, rather than actually informing people, we misinform them. You know, we actually give them a false image of what's going on there. And so you hear it, you know, on the street, you know, sometimes in London, like I'll end up having a conversation with a stranger. That's a rare thing in London, because if you talk to strangers in London, people generally assume you're crazy. But, you know, you'll strike up a conversation with someone and, you know, you'll say that you work on the Middle East, and they'll say, oh, you know, yeah, they've been fighting there for, you know, since the dawn of time. It's like, actually, they haven't. You know, this isn't, you know, that's, but this is just like the graveyard of empires, you know, ancient hatred. So one of the reasons why I've been pushing it back against the graveyard of empires trope isn't just because of the graveyard of empires trope itself being horribly wrong, but it represents possibly one of the most prominent examples of a whole genre of discourse, which you could call bad Middle East takes, which sounds like the name of a Twitter account. In fact, I'm pretty sure I've seen a Twitter account with that name. But
There isn't one, there should be, because I've seen a lot of bad Middle East takes.
There are a lot of bad takes out there. But the thing is, it's the whole way in which we talk about the Middle East. And then, you know, and you this isn't harmless. This isn't harmless, because you realize that, you know, as soon as you realize that lawmakers and government officials, in many cases, aren't that much better informed than any other educated person, you know, in London or Washington or Paris or wherever, you know, they all read the same newspapers we do. You know, not all of them, you know, not all of them are Middle East experts. Not all of them have ever set foot in the Middle East. And yet they're expected to vote on policy to do with the Middle East. You know, when tropes like this are put out into the discourse, what it does is it creates a false image of the world. And we buy into that image of the world. And then we start making plans and policies on the basis of that false image. And, you know, in this case, you know, we could look at the case of Afghanistan. Last 20 years, I would say there were probably a constellation of false images there, myths about nation building. For example, you know, like the golden arches, you know, the golden arches theory, the idea that if we just put a McDonald's in Kabul, that's it. We've won. You know, you get it. That can actually be dangerous. People can die for that reason. And in this case, with the graveyard of empires trip, I just wonder, and I can't prove that this is the case. But I do wonder, like at least in the last 10 years, when it became clear that we hadn't won the Afghan war, to what extent were policymakers sort of in their darker moments just saying, oh, it's the graveyard of empires. What can we do? You know, because if you buy into that, and a lot of people clearly do buy into it, or at least they see it as a useful narrative to put out there to justify what they're doing. You know, if enough people buy into that, then that kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, and it's shown by the fact, look, we've literally left Afghanistan. I wish I could say more or less as we found it. We've left it in a worse state than we found it. And, oh, well, it's the graveyard of empires. What could we do? It was inevitable.
It's crazy. There's a quote going around saying, and I think people are attributing it to Norman Finkelstein, but I don't know if he actually said this, but he said the quote is, you know, if you ever feel bad about yourself, you're ever feeling down, you know, just remember the U.S. spent trillions of dollars on Afghanistan to defeat the Taliban, only for the Taliban to come back into power 20 years later. We replaced the Taliban with the Taliban.
Yeah, I saw that one. Yeah, with the replace. So I saw they spent trillions of dollars to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. You know, again, which is true. And you just sort of look at that and you say, well, clearly something went wrong there. And without saying that we should be able to predict the future, I do think that when you have a catastrophic failure like this, it's actually important to take stock of that and understand why. And one of the reasons why we've seen this catastrophic failure, not just in Afghanistan, but in Iraq as well, is because, you know, is these tropes. Is this language that was deployed? I mean, we saw it in, you know, Iraq as well. You know, we'll be greeted as liberators. You know, I mean, you know, Thomas Friedman was cheering on about how we're going to, you know, spread democracy in the Middle East. You know, just completely divorced from reality. And then, of course, though, but then this is the flip side, because then, of course, when you have a civil war starting in Iraq, a sectarian civil war. Oh, well, ancient hatreds.
And it's also just like, it doesn't take into account how we've contributed a lot to the worsening of tensions, right? So like, we were talking about all these interpreters who are in danger now and people who worked with the Afghan government. And, you know, to play or to get inside the mind of Taliban fighters, I can see why Taliban fighters would be like, well, you were collaborators with the U.S. You know, the U.S. were bombing us. We don't like you and we're coming after you now. So I get where they're thinking. But at the same time, I also get where, you know, these interpreters and people that worked with the U.S. government are like, hey, we were fighting with the U.S. The U.S. is just leaving us behind. Yeah, and now the Taliban's going to get us. It's like we made a worse situation even worse.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, but that's the thing. They were fighting because they believed in the vision we sold them of a, you know, of a democratic Afghanistan, of an Afghanistan that has had a future. It feels cruel. And, you know, again, yeah, I'm not saying that we should have stayed there indefinitely, no matter the cost. But I do think that there were probably better ways of leaving than the US and her allies did. And I think once again, you know, the Afghan people are paying the price here. It's, you know, the burden or the cost, really. You know, we can talk about spending trillions of dollars. In reality, a lot of those trillions of dollars went straight back into the pockets of, you know, private military contractors, weapons manufacturers. I mean, just look at the, you know, just to give you an idea of this, look at the stock price of Lockheed Martin.
I was going to say, I always tell people, you know, in a way, it was a nation building exercise, not for Afghanistan, but for Virginia, because that's where all the contractors are.
Well, they made a killing. I mean, Lockheed Martin's stock price is worth 10 times what it was in 2001 when the war started. So, you know, we talk about trillions of dollars, but a lot of, you know, I would question how much of those trillions actually reached any Afghan people and how much of it actually went into the pockets of American weapons manufacturers, private military contractors, and so on.
Not even just that, but you know, these weapons contractors do hire Americans and whatnot. And I'm not saying like all Americans are complicit or whatever, but the biggest victims in this are the Afghans. It's not necessarily us.
No, it's not. And I think what troubles me as well is in some cases you've sort of seen people who are more outraged that pets have been left behind in Afghanistan, rescue animals have been left behind in Afghanistan. They're more outraged about that than the fact that translators, interpreters, human rights activists, and others have been left behind.
Well, I would say a lot of them are even more upset about, you know, leaving animals behind than they were us bombing them for years.
Yeah, I mean, this is just it. There's so much wrong with the way in which the war has been explained and presented in Western countries. And even now, you see it in the headlines. For example, when there was the suicide bombing at Kabul airport that ISK carried out, the headlines all focused on the American dead. You know, I forget how much was it, you know, 13 American soldiers lost their lives, which, of course, is a tragedy because a lot of these soldiers were, you know, kids when 9/11 happened. Some of them couldn't even walk. And, you know, any death is tragic. But hold on, more than 10 times that number of Afghan civilians died at that airport, including people who were, British citizens, maybe U.S. citizens. You know, there were other people who died there and they don't even get a mention. So it's like, what was it? I think it was like 30. The one headline I saw was like 13 American soldiers dead and dozens of Afghans. It's like, you know, they don't even get a number. It's like, oh, just too many to count. And I think that's the whole problem with the way in which we, because as long as we continue to look at the world in a way that that privileges the lives of the people that live within this little bubble in the Northwest, you know, mostly in the Northwest of the globe. You know, we're never going to be able to understand, you know, why a movement like the Taliban gains popular support. But if you actually go and, as some reporters and you know, specialists have done. If you actually go and speak to them, you realize, well, this is, you know, there's a reason why people support them. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that if you were outside the cities in Afghanistan, you lived in fear of drone strikes. You know, so that, again, that's not to say we should sympathize with the Taliban or you know, or say that you know, that they're not the good guys in this either. But I think it's very, again, you know, coming back to this graveyard of empires narrative, it's just self-serving when we're not willing to acknowledge our complicity in the outcome we're facing. And the real problem is then that dooms us to repeat those mistakes. You know, it's a, you know, to do this again, to inflict this suffering on yet another country in the Middle East or Central Asia, you know, 10 years down the line, and invoke similar cliches. And you know, and it, again, it's not just Afghanistan, you know, the whole Middle East, Central Asia. I mean, the fact that we refer to you know, countries like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan as the Stans, as if they're all sort of just one homogenous, you know, blob of Central Asia. There was a very good article I read on that recently. Again, you know, it just reflects the poor state of our knowledge about the rest of the world. And this is something that, you know, we have to change, especially because, you know, with globalization and other forces at play, you know, we are now more closely connected and more dependent on each other than ever before. But if we keep buying into these lazy stereotypes, we're going to keep doing stupid things.
In a way, and this will be the note we end on, because I know I've kept you for a little bit over. You mentioned the whole, you know, that's not to say we're sympathizing with the Taliban or that we're saying the Taliban are the good guys. It's interesting to me that you brought up that good guys line, though, because I think when people talk about geopolitics in a really, I would say, crude manner, a lot of people, and I saw this a lot when I was in college, and I even see older people do it, I'm not sure that anyone on the quote-unquote grand chessboard, I'm not sure has clear good guys and clear bad guys. And maybe that's the worst stereotype of all that we deal with, is it's not a cartoon. It's not a cartoon. Yeah. It's not good guys versus bad guys. It's, there are many shades of gray, and you know, everyone has their atrocities, all sides in the sort of geopolitical grand chessboard.
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to say very fine people on both sides, or in this case, the opposite, very bad people on both sides. You know, yeah, I don't think when we look at the field of international relations, when we look at, you know, history, no one's hands are clean. And that's not to absolve, that doesn't absolve anyone.
I hope I'm not giving anyone that impression with what I said.
No, I'm sure, you know, likewise. But I think the first, in a way, one of the first lies we need to jettison is the idea that there are good guys, or there is a good war. Don't get me wrong, there are plenty of good people out there. There are plenty of people who do wonderful things. But I think, you know, we shouldn't anthropomorphize nation states into thinking, you know, that there are good guys and there are bad guys. I mean, this isn't G.I. Joe. You know, there are complexities here. There are, you know, there are interests at work. It may make good political rhetoric. I mean, indeed, if you look at, for all the panic about, you know, virtue signaling at the moment, you know, on the right, you know, the right love to sort of accuse the left of virtue signaling. The right in the Bush administration were some of the biggest virtue signalers of all. I mean, they basically launched two massive wars and military occupation.
Well, hey, let's be honest here real quick. I think anti-virtue signaling is now its own form of virtue signaling. Yeah.
Well, in that case, that means I'm virtue signaling here by calling out the Bush administration for virtue signaling. But I mean, you know, it made great political rhetoric, you know, that we were fighting a good and just war. But at the far end of it, you know, after 20 years, it's, and the interesting thing, of course, is that Afghanistan for a long time was seen as the good war. Iraq was the debacle. Iraq was the, you know, the bad war. That was the war that we should never have started. That was the war that was based on lies. But then people would sort of, you know, would still support the Afghan war because that was the good war. That was the war against Osama bin Laden. That was the war against the Taliban. That was the just and right war. And yet, sort of looking back now after 20 years, it's it's much harder to make that assessment. It's much harder to sort of agree with that sentiment, knowing what we know, both about sort of the conduct of the war and its ultimate outcomes. So yeah, absolutely. We need to put to bed this idea that there are good guys. I'm not saying that it's not possible for nation states to do good things, but I think if someone's telling you we're the good guys, we should probably question why they're telling us that.
Well, hey, I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you, Alex, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work? And if there's anything, I always ask this at the end of the show, is there anything you really hope listeners got out of this conversation?
If no one ever says the phrase graveyard of empires again, I think I could just die a happy man. If there's one takeaway that I hope your listeners have gotten from this, and thank you again for having me on here to discuss with you and to sort of, you know, to talk about these things. If there's one thing I hope they could have taken away from this, it's that nuance, when it comes to, Afghanistan and the Middle East, the word nuance, and just to reject oversimplifications, simple narratives, and also to remember that, you know, people in Afghanistan and the Middle East are pretty much just like you and I. They have a lot of the same aspirations. They want their kids to go to school. It isn't some alien planet where up is down and down is up. And just as things in our countries are complex and they're and allied simple explanations, the same is true over there. It's, you know, human affairs are messy. And what we try to do, me as a historian and other people in social sciences and analysis, what we try to do is we try to identify useful patterns. We try to make sense of it. So I hope that your listeners will have, you know, maybe learn a little bit more about Afghanistan, although it sounds like with all the guests you've had on, they probably know more than I do now. I hope that they've learned a little bit of Afghanistan. They've learned a little bit about, you know, the importance of nuance and the way we talk about other countries. And if they want to follow my work, I'm on Twitter. So @Alex_Khalili is my handle. And there you will find me. I mean, at the moment, it's mostly me tweeting stuff about Afghanistan and Afghan history, and especially how it's covered in the media. But more generally, I will be tweeting about sort of the history of Iran and Central Asia too. So it isn't, it's more than just current affairs. And it's been really, really great to come on here and talk to you, and also to have an opportunity to speak to your listeners. So thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alexander Khalili, and let me know what your thoughts on the Graveyard of Empires trope are by dropping me a line on Twitter @ViewsParallax or by email @ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. And of course, if you appreciate the work I'm doing here at Parallax Views, please, 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 please consider supporting me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Monthly donations of $1, $5, $10, or $15 all accepted. And trust me, even though I get a little bit of money from ads, I am hanging on by a thread. I guess that's the journalist/independent media personality's life. The struggle, as they say, is real. But if you can support me at any of the monthly donation tiers, I would very, very much appreciate it. And at the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout-out, which leads us to the producer's credit shout-outs for this episode. Shout-outs to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Gunner, Ed, Gratz, James, Mickey, Brian, The Warner, TJ, Nick, Emilia, Chase, Chris, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, David, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views,
Well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. It's come to my attention that some people at the $10 tier haven't gotten shoutouts recently. And what I need you to do, if that's the case, Patreon hasn't always notified me. There's been some issues with that. I don't know what's going on there. I have to contact Patreon about it. But there has been an incident here and there where someone has not been mentioned in the producer's credit shoutouts. If you just email me, I will add you to the producer's credits list. And trust me, I am not intentionally leaving you out. For some reason, Patreon doesn't always list some of the names at the $10 tier. When I look up the $10 tier on my Patreon page, I don't know what that's about. I think it's just a glitch. So if that's happening with you, please, please, please just send me a message on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. But again, if you can, please, please, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.